I, Joe, John, when we were first acquit. That was the extent of it. No clue who the poet was, though the name Robert Burns lurked somewhere at the back of my brain. I wondered if William's father was correct in his belief that memorizing poetry served us later in life. Cheney and I exchanged a look. He was adorable. No lie. Or maybe my perception was colored by the comfort of his being on the scene. Let him deal with Solana and her goon of a son. While Cheney and Henry chatted, I had the opportunity to study him. He wore dress slacks and a shirt with a button-down collar, over which he pulled a caramel-colored cashmere coat. Cheney came from money, and while he had no desire to work in his father's bank, he was smart enough to enjoy the perks. I could tell I was weakening in the same way I weaken at the notion of a QP with cheese. Not that he was good for me, but who cared? "Did you talk to her?" Henry asked. Cheney said, "That's why I'm here. We're wondering if the two of you would step next door with us." Henry said, "Certainly. Is something wrong?" "You tell us. When we pulled up, we found the front door standing open. All the lights are on, but there doesn't seem to be anyone there." Henry left with Cheney and Officer Anderson without bothering to put a coat over his short-sleeved shirt. I paused long enough to retrieve my jacket from the back of the kitchen chair. I grabbed Henry's as well and scooted after him. The night was chilly, and the wind was picking up. There was an empty expanse of curb where Solana's car had been. I trotted along the walk, reassured by the notion that Cheney had the situation under control. He was right about Gus's house. Every room was ablaze with light. By the time I crossed his front yard, I could see Anderson on his way around the side of the house with his flashlight, the wand of white zigzagging across the windows, the walkway, and surrounding shrubbery. Cheney had Solana Rojas's arrest warrant in hand, and I gathered that gave him a certain leeway to check the premises in search of her. He'd also uncovered two outstanding warrants for the arrest of Tommaso Tassonato, one on charges of aggravated battery, and the other for battery with great bodily harm. He told us Tiny had twice been caught on tape shoplifting items from a Colgate mini-mart. The owner had identified him, but then decided not to file charges, saying he didn't want the hassle over some beef jerky and two packages of M&Ms. Cheney asked us to wait outside while he went in. Henry shrugged himself into his jacket and tucked his hands in the pockets. Neither of us said a word, but he must have worried, as I did, that something awful was in store. Once Cheney assured himself the place was empty, he asked us to walk through with him to see if we noticed anything out of the ordinary. The premises had been picked clean of personal items. In my earlier unauthorized home invasion, I hadn't noticed how barren the house was. The living room was intact. Furniture still in place, lamps, the desk, a footstool, fake roses on the coffee table. The kitchen was untouched as well. Nothing out of place. If there'd been dirty dishes in the sink, they'd been washed, dried, and put away. A damp-looking linen dish towel had been folded and hung neatly across the rack. The spray bottle of cleanser was gone, but the smell was still strong. I thought Solana was taking her compulsive tidiness a bit too far. Gus's room was just as we'd left it. The covers were flung back, sheets and spread rumpled and looking not quite clean. Drawers still stood half open where Peggy'd hunted for a sweater for him. The humidifier had run dry and no longer hissed with steam. I continued down the hall to the first of the two spare bedrooms. Compared with the last view I'd had, Solana's room was empty. The carved mahogany bed frame remained, but the other antique pieces were gone. No burled walnut rocking chair, no armoire, no plump-shouldered fruitwood chest of drawers with ornate bronze drawer pulls. She couldn't have loaded furniture in her car in the scant hour she had available after she returned home. For one thing, the items were too cumbersome, and for another, she was in too great a hurry to bother. This meant she'd disposed of the furniture earlier, but who knew what she'd done with it? In the closet, the hangers had been shoved apart, and most of her clothes were gone. Some garments had tumbled to the floor, and she'd left them in a heap. indicating the haste with which she'd packed. I moved to Tiny's room. Henry and Chaney stood in the doorway. I kept expecting to find a body, his or hers, shot, stabbed, or hanged. Uneasily, I eased in behind Chaney, hoping he would shield me from anything gross. The air in Tiny's room was dense with guy smell, testosterone, hair, sweat glands, and dirty clothes. Overlying the ripe odor was the same smell of bleach I'd noticed throughout. Had she been using the spray cleanser to wipe the surfaces free of prints? The two heavy blankets that served as blackout curtains were still nailed to the window frames, and the overhead light was tawny and ineffectual. The television set was gone, but all of Tiny's toiletries were still strewn across the counter in the bathroom he shared with his mom. He'd left his toothbrush behind, but he probably didn't use it anyway, so no big deal. Officer Anderson appeared in the hallway behind us. "Anybody know what kind of car she drives?" Chaney said, "A 1972 Chevrolet convertible with the word dead scratched into the driver's side door." Pierce made a note of the plate number in his field notes. "I think we got it. Come take a look at this." He went out the back door, flipping on the porch light as he passed. We followed him down the steps and across the yard to the single-car garage at the rear of the lot. The old wooden doors were padlocked, but he held his flashlight against the dusty window. I had to stand on tiptoe to see in, but the car inside was Solana's. The convertible top was down and the front and rear seats were empty to all appearances. It was clear Chaney'd need a search warrant before he went further. "Did Mr. Vronsky own a vehicle?" he asked. Henry said, "He did. A 1976 Buick Electra, metallic blue with a blue interior. His pride and joy. He hadn't driven it for years, and I'm sure the tags on the license plate expired. I don't know the license number, but a car like that shouldn't be hard to spot." "The DMV will have the information. I'll notify the sheriff's department and the CHP. Any idea which direction she might have headed?" "No clue," Henry said. Before he left, Anderson secured both the house and garage with crime scene tape in anticipation of a return with a warrant and a fingerprint technician. Chaney wasn't optimistic about recovering the cash and other valuables Solana had stolen over the years, but there was always a chance. At the very least, latent fingerprints would tie the cases together. "Hey, Chaney," I said as he was getting in his car. He looked across the top of his car at me. "When the techs dust for prints, tell them to try the vodka bottle in the cabinet above the sink. She probably didn't think to wipe that down before she left." Chaney smiled. "Will do." Henry and I went back to his house. "I'm heading over to the hospital, and after that I'll hit Rosie's," I said. "Care to join me?"
"I'd love to, but Charlotte said she'd stop by at 8. I'm taking her to dinner."
"Really? Well, that's interesting."
"I don't know how interesting it is. I treated her poorly over the business with Gus. I was a butt, and the time has come to make that right."
I left him to get himself gussied up and walked the half block to my car. The drive to St. Terry's took less than 15 minutes, which gave me time to ponder Solana's vanishing and Chaney's reappearance. I knew it wouldn't be smart to renew that relationship. On the other hand, there's always that other hand, isn't there? I'd caught a whiff of his aftershave and nearly whimpered aloud. I parked on a side street and headed for the brightly lighted hospital entrance. My intended visit with Gus was short-lived. When I reached the floor and identified myself, I was told he was still asleep. I chatted briefly with the charge nurse, making sure she was clear about who was allowed to see him and who was not. Peggy had laid all the necessary groundwork, and I was assured his safety was uppermost in everyone's mind. I did peek in at him and spent a half a minute watching him sleep. His color had already improved. There was one bright moment that made the whole excursion worthwhile. I'd rung for the elevator, and I was waiting. I heard the whir of cables and the ping announcing its arrival from the floor below. When the doors opened, I found myself face to face with Nancy Sullivan. She had her good Girl Scout briefcase in one hand, and she was wearing her sensible shoes. As proof there's justice in the world, she'd been assigned to Gus's case after having blown me off. She greeted me coolly, using a tone that implied she hoped I'd fall in a hole. I didn't say a word to her, but I did gloat in my heart. I resisted the urge to smirk until after the elevator doors closed, shutting her from sight. Then I mouthed the sweetest four words in the English language. I told you so. I drove home, fantasizing about my dinner at Rosie's. I was going for the fat and cholesterol sweepstakes. Bread and butter, red meat, sour cream on everything, and a big gooey dessert. I'd take a paperback novel with me and read while I stuffed my face. I could hardly wait. When I turned onto Albanil, I could see how scarce the parking was. I'd forgotten it was hump night again, and the midweek revelers had put parking spaces at a premium. In search of a spot, I cruised the street at half speed, scanning for two other things as well. The sight of a black and white, indicating the police had returned to Gus's house, or the sight of a telltale metallic blue Buick Electra, a sign that Solana was close by. No sign of either. I turned the corner onto Bay and drove to the end of the block without seeing a car length of empty curb. I turned right on Cabana and right again on Albanil, checking the block again. Ahead, on the sidewalk, I spotted a woman in a trench coat and high heels. My headlights picked up a flash of hair, too blonde to be real. Hooker hair, all tarted up and dyed. This gal was huge, and even from the rear I could tell something was off. It wasn't until I passed that I realized it was a guy in drag. I turned my head and squinted. Was that Tiny? I kept an eye on him in my rearview mirror. A spot had opened up and I angled into it. Before I shut down the engine, I glanced back at the sidewalk. No sign of the babe, so I rolled down my window an inch to listen for the clopping of her high heels on concrete. The street was quiet. If it was Tiny, he'd either retraced his steps or turned the corner. I didn't like it. I removed the key from the ignition, clutching the ring in my fist, keys through my fingers. I looked over my right shoulder once more, checking the sidewalk before I opened the car door. The handle was jerked out of my hand, and the door was flung open. I was hauled up by the hair and yanked from the car. I hit the pavement on my backside, pain searing my tailbone. I recognized Tiny by smell, corrosive and foul. I flailed, glancing back at him. His platinum wig was askew, and I could see the stubble on his face that even a late afternoon shave hadn't fully eradicated. He'd shucked his trench coat and kicked off his high heels. He wore a woman's blouse, and his size 28 skirt now rode up over his hips, allowing him freedom of movement. His hands were still buried in my hair. I grabbed them, lifting myself in an effort to keep him from ripping off my scalp. My keys had fallen on the street, half under the car. No time to worry about that now. I was struggling for purchase. I managed to get my feet under me and kicked his right knee. The heel on my boot might have done some damage, except for his bulk, which made him almost impervious to pain. He was pumped up on adrenaline, doubtless hyped on his sense of himself. The hair on his calves and the lower part of his thighs was pressed flat by a pair of queen-sized pantyhose. Runners snaked down from the crotch where the nylon had been stretched to the limit. He was making guffing sounds deep in his throat, half exertion, half excitement at the notion of the injuries he'd inflict before he was done with me. We grappled, both of us down on the pavement now. He was on his back, and I lay on my back as well, sprawled awkwardly on top of him. He was scissoring his legs in an attempt to encircle me and lock my body between his thighs. I reached back and clawed at his face, hoping to gouge an eye. My nails raked his cheek, which he must have felt, because he punched me in the head so hard, I swore I could feel my brain bouncing against the inside of my skull. The fucker outweighed me by a good 200 pounds. He pinned my arms against me. His grip was vice-like, and close up against him like that, my elbows were of no use. He rocked back, thrusting himself forward, trying to hook one foot around the other for leverage. I managed to turn my body halfway and use the bony structure of my pelvis as a wedge to keep his big knees apart. I knew what he'd do. Clamp down, force the air out of my lungs with the increased pressure of his thighs. Clamp down again,
He'd use compression like a boa constrictor, tightening his legs around me until I ceased to draw breath. I couldn't make a sound. In the heaving silence, I marveled at the sense of solitude. There was no one else on the street. No one even remotely aware that we were out here, joined in the strange embrace. He'd begun to mew. Joy. Sexual arousal. I wasn't sure which. I slipped down, the heavy flesh of his thighs now pressing on each side of my face. He was hot, sweating between his legs as he squeezed. His weight alone was sufficient to crush me. Without exerting any other effort, he could have sat on my chest, and it would have taken less than 30 seconds before the dark came down. I was deaf. His thighs had shut out all sound except for the hush of blood moving through his veins. I squirmed and rotated myself inches. I turned again until my nose was smashed up against the crotch of his pantyhose, with its soft, helpless bulge in range. He didn't have a hard-on, that much was obvious. Any clothing other than pantyhose would have offered him protection. Heavy jeans or sweats serving as a jockstrap or a codpiece of sorts, shielding his nuts. But he was turned on by the feel of silkiness against his naked skin. Such is life. We all have our preferences. I opened my jaws and bit down on his scrotum. I closed my eyes and clamped down until I thought my upper and lower teeth would meet in the middle. The wad in my mouth had the consistency of foam rubber with a touch of grizzle at the core. I held on, like a terrier, knowing the searing message of pain was streaking like lightning through his frame. A howl went up, and his thighs popped open as though they were spring-loaded, letting the cold air rush in. I rolled over on my side, scrambling on my hands and knees as far as the car. He was thrashing on the ground behind me, gasping and groaning. He clutched his crotch where I hoped I'd inflicted permanent damage. He wept, his cries hoarse with anguish and disbelief. I felt around for my car keys and snatched them up. I was shaking so badly I dropped them and had to scoop them up again. He'd managed to pull himself upright, but he paused to puke before he staggered to his feet. His face was sweaty and pale, and he held himself with one hand while he limped in my direction. His obesity and his lumbering gait slowed him just long enough to allow me to open the car door and slide in. I slammed the door and banged the knob into the locked position as he grabbed the door handle and yanked. I flung myself across the passenger seat and banged the knob down on that door as well. Then I sat there, lungs heaving while I gathered my strength. He slammed both his hands down on the roof of the car and pushed, trying to rock it with the force of his weight. If I'd been trapped in my beloved VW, he'd have rolled the car over on its side and then over on its roof. The Mustang, he couldn't budge beyond the faintest shudder. He had no tolerance for frustration. He grabbed the windshield wiper and twisted it, bending it until it stuck out like a dislocated finger. I could see him searching for something else to destroy. He circled the car. Mesmerized, I kept him in sight, turning my head as he moved around the rear and reappeared on my left. He was making sounds that might have been English, but the words were flattened and formless, without the dots and dashes of vowels and consonants to make them distinct. He skipped back two steps and ran at the car. He side-kicked the door. I knew he'd put a dent in the metal, but given that he was shoeless and clad in pantyhose, he'd hurt himself more than he'd hurt the car. He yanked at the door again. He banged a fist against the glass and then tried to force his big meaty fingers into the crack between the window and the post. I felt like a mouse in a glass case with a snake outside, hissing and striking ineffectually, while fear shot through me like zaps from a taser gun. There was a hypnotic quality to his assault, fierce and relentless. How long would it take him to breach my small fortress? I didn't dare abandon the safety of the car, which was at least keeping him at bay. I leaned on the car horn until the sound filled the night air. He moved around the car again, prowling, looking for a weakness in my fortifications. He was clearly infuriated to have me in plain sight, but inaccessible. He stood on the driver's side staring at me, and then, abruptly, he turned away. I thought he was leaving, but he walked across the street, and at the far side, turned to face me again. There was something in his eyes so crazy that I hummed with fear. With a jangle of keys, I managed to jam the right one in the ignition. I turned it, and the engine roared to life. I jerked the wheel to my left and swung away from the curb. I knew it would take two tries before I cleared the bumper of the car in front of me. I backed up and turned the wheel again. I glanced over as Tiny began to run at the car with more speed than I'd have thought possible for a guy his size. He pulled his right fist back, and when he reached the car, he drove it straight through the window, shattering the glass. I screamed and ducked as jagged shards flew by, some landing in my lap. The glass that remained in the window tore into his flesh. His punching arm was extended as far as his shoulder blade, but when he tried to pull it free, glass bit into the fabric of his blouse like the angled teeth of a shark. He groped for me blindly, and I felt his fingers close around my throat. The simple fact of physical contact jolted me into action. I shoved the stick into first, popped the clutch, and floored it. The Mustang shot forward with a squeal of burning tires. Out of the corner of my eye, I could still see Tiny's arm and hand, like the branch of a tree driven through a wall by a gale-force wind. I slammed on the brakes, thinking I could shake him off. That's when I realized I was suffering a misperception. Between his own weight and my speed, I'd left him half a block behind. It was only his arm that remained, resting lightly on my shoulder like an old chum's. Chapter 35. I won't go into a moment-by-moment account of what followed in the wake of that grisly incident. Much of it I've forgotten, in any event. I do remember Officer Anderson arriving in his patrol car and Cheney's arriving later in his slick little red Mercedes convertible. My car was parked where I'd left it, and I was, by then, sitting on the curb in front of Henry's house, shaking as though suffering from a neurological disorder. Having battled with Tiny, I sported sufficient contusions and abrasions to lend credibility to my account of his attack. My head was still ringing from the punch. Since there were already warrants out on him for similar offenses, no one suggested that I was to blame. These were the facts that worked in my favor. At the time of the accident, I stopped and approached the injured man with every intention of rendering assistance if necessary, which it wasn't because he was dead. According to the breathalyzer and later blood analysis, I was not driving under the influence of alcohol or drugs. When the officer from the traffic division arrived on the scene, I gave him my name, address, registration, and proof of insurance. I had a valid California driver's license in my possession. He ran my name, license number, and plate, and determined that my record was clean. I was worried he'd pick up on the Tiny matter of the TRO, but since we hadn't yet appeared in court, the restraining order probably wasn't in the system. Besides which, I hadn't done a thing to her. There was a suggestion to the effect that I might have used excessive force in defending myself, but that opinion was quashed forthwith. The Mustang was in the shop for repairs for a week. The windshield wiper and the window on the driver's side would have to be replaced. The driver's side door was dented, and the white vinyl bucket seat on the driver's side was a loss. No matter how often or how thoroughly the upholstery was cleaned, there would always be traces of red in the seams. Whether I'd hang on to the Mustang was another matter altogether. Owning the car was like owning a fine thoroughbred racehorse. Beautiful to behold, but expensive to maintain. The car had saved my life, no doubt about that. But I wondered if every time I drove it, I'd see Tiny starting that fatal run with his right fist pulled back. Gus was discharged after 2 days in the hospital. Melanie went through a local agency and made arrangements for a new companion for him. The woman did light housekeeping, prepared his meals, ran errands, and went home at night to a family of her own. Of course, Gus fired her at the end of 2 weeks. The subsequent companion has survived to date, though Henry reports hearing a good deal of bickering from the far side of the hedge. A week after Tiny's death, Gus's Buick Electra was found in Chula Vista, just south of San Diego, 6 blocks from the Mexican border. It had been wiped clean of prints, but there was a stack of oil paintings locked in the trunk that were later valued at close to $1 million. Solana must have hated abandoning such assets, but she couldn't very well disappear while continuing to hang on to a carload of stolen art. One happy side effect of her disappearance was that she was a no-show in court the day of the hearing on the restraining order. The matter was dismissed, but I was still going to need a judge's orders to get my guns back. I knew in my heart of hearts I wasn't done with her, nor she with me. I'd been responsible for the death of her only child, and I'd pay for that. In the meantime, I told myself there was no point in worrying. Solana was gone, and if she came back, she'd come back and I'd deal with her then. I put the matter behind me. It was done, done, done. I couldn't change what had happened, and I couldn't give in to the emotions that ran like a riptide under the placid surface I presented to the world. Henry knew better. Tactfully, he probed, wondering aloud how I was coping with Tiny's death, suggesting that perhaps I might benefit from talking to someone. "I don't want to talk to anyone," I said. "I did what I had to do. He didn't have to attack me. He didn't have to jam his fist through the glass. Those were his choices. I made mine. What's the big deal? It's not like he's the first guy I ever killed." "Well, that puts it in a fresh light." "Henry, I appreciate your concern, but it's misplaced." I was aware that I sounded testy, but aside from that, I felt fine. At least, that's what I told him, and anyone else who asked. Despite the brave face I wore, I went through my days with a low-level dread I could scarcely acknowledge. I wanted closure. I needed to have all the loose ends tied up. As long as she was out there, I didn't feel safe. I was afraid. Terrified was a better word. I realized later I was experiencing a form of post-traumatic stress disorder, but at the time, all I knew was how hard I had to work to suppress my anxiety. I had no appetite. I didn't have trouble falling asleep, but I'd wake up at 4 a.m., and that would be the end of it. I couldn't concentrate. I was fearful of crowds and unnerved by loud noises. At the end of every day, I was exhausted from having to maintain such a tight grip on myself. Fear, like any other strong emotion, is difficult to hide. Much of my energy was devoted to denying it was there. My only relief came from my early morning run. I craved movement. I loved the feeling of flying over the ground. I needed to be sweaty and out of breath. If my legs hurt and my lungs burned, all the better. There was something tangible about the calm that came over me when I was done. I started pushing myself, adding a mile to the three I typically put in. When that wasn't quite enough, I ramped up the pace. The lull was short-lived. Sunday, February 14th, was the last day I'd be able to enjoy the quiet, artificial though it may have been. In the coming week, though I didn't know it yet, Solana would make her move. Valentine's Day was Henry's birthday, and Rosie treated us to dinner to celebrate his turning 88. The restaurant was closed on Sundays, so we had the place to ourselves. Rosie put together a feast, and William helped serve. There were just the four of us, Rosie, William, Henry, and me. We had to do without Louis, Charlie, and Nell because the Midwest was socked in with snow and the Sibs were stranded until the airport opened again. Henry and Charlotte had mended their fences. I thought for sure he'd invite her, but he was reluctant to stir up any suggestion of romance between them. She would always be too driven and single-minded for his laid-back lifestyle. He said he wanted only his nearest and dearest with him while he blew out his candles, beaming at our lusty rendition of "Happy Birthday to You." Rosie, William, and I pooled our money and bought him three copper-bottom saucepans that he adored. Monday morning, I got to work at 8. Early for me, but I hadn't slept well, and I'd ended up going out for my run at 5:30 instead of 6, which put me at the office half an hour ahead of my usual time. One virtue of my office, perhaps the only virtue, was that there was always parking available in front. I parked, locked my car, and let myself in. There was the usual hillock of mail, piled on the floor under the slot. Most of it was junk that would go straight into the trash, but topmost was a padded envelope that I assumed was another set of documents from Lowell Effinger's office. Melvin Downs had failed to appear for his deposition, and I'd promised Geneva that I'd go after him again and have another heart-to-heart. Clearly, he'd been unimpressed by the threat of contempt of court. I dropped my shoulder bag on my desk. I slid out of my jacket and draped it over the back of my chair. I tackled the manila envelope, which was stapled shut, and took a bit of doing before I opened it. I separated the flaps and looked in. At the first glance, I shrieked and flung the envelope across the room. The action was involuntary, a reflex triggered by revulsion. What I'd glimpsed was the hairy appendages of a live tarantula. I literally shuddered, but I didn't have time to calm myself or gather my wits. Horrified, I watched the tarantula feel its way out of the padded mailer, one hairy leg at a time, tentatively testing the characteristics of my beige carpeting. The spider looked huge, but in fact, the squat body was no more than an inch and a half wide, suspended from a set of eight bright red legs that seemed to move independently of one another. The front and rear parts of its body were round, and its legs appeared to have joints like little bent elbows or knees, which terminated in small, flat paws. Body and legs together, the spider could have filled a circle 4 inches across. With mincing steps, the tarantula crawled across the floor, looking like an ambulatory wad of black and red hair. If I didn't find a way to stop it, it would scuttle into one of the spaces between my file cabinets and reside there for life. What was I supposed to do? Stepping on a spider that size was out of the question. I didn't want to get that close to it, and I didn't want to see stuff squirt out when I crushed it to death. I certainly wasn't going to whack it with a magazine. My distaste aside, the spider represented no danger. Tarantulas aren't poisonous, but they're ugly as sin. Mossy with hair, eight glittering round eyes, and I kid you not, fangs that were visible from half a room away. Oblivious to my concerns, the tarantula tiptoed out of my office with a certain daintiness and proceeded to cross the reception area. I was afraid it might stretch and elongate, insinuating itself under the baseboard like a cat slipping under a fence. I kept a wary eye on it, rapidly backing down the hall to my kitchenette. On Friday, I'd washed the clear glass coffee carafe and set it upside down on a towel to dry. I grabbed it and sped back, amazed at the distance the tarantula had covered in just those few seconds. I didn't dare pause to consider how repellent it was at close range. I made my mind a blank, turned the carafe upside down, and set it over him. Then I shuddered again, a groan emanating from some primitive part of me. I backed away from the carafe, patting myself on the chest. I'd never use that carafe again. I couldn't bear to drink from a coffee pot that spider feet had touched. I hadn't solved my problem. I'd only delayed the inevitable issue of how to dispose of it. What were my choices? Animal control? A local tarantula rescue group? I didn't dare set it free in the wild, that being the patch of ivy outside my door, because I'd always be searching the ground for it, wondering when it was going to pop out again. It's times like these when you need a guy around. Though I'd have been willing to bet most men would have been as disgusted as I was, and just about as squeamish at the idea of spider guts. I went back to my desk, sidestepping the empty manila envelope, which I'd have to burn. I took out the telephone book and looked up the number for the Museum of Natural History. The woman who answered the phone didn't behave as though my situation was unusual. She checked her Rolodex and recited the number of a fellow in town who actually bred tarantulas. Then she informed me, with a certain giddiness, that his lecture, complete with a live demonstration, was a favorite among elementary school kids who liked having the spiders crawl up and down their arms. I put the image out of my mind as I dialed the number she'd given me. I wasn't sure what to expect of someone who made a living consorting with tarantulas. The young man who arrived at my office door half an hour later was in his early 20s, big and soft, with a beard that was probably meant to lend him an air of maturity. "Are you Kinsey? Brian Coe. Thanks for the call." I shook his hand, trying not to bubble over with gratitude. His grip was light and his palm was warm. I looked at him with the same devotion I accorded my plumber the day the hose on the washing machine came loose and spewed water everywhere. I appreciate your being so prompt. I'm happy to be of help. His smile was sweet, and his thicket of blonde hair was as big as a burning bush. He wore denim overalls, a short-sleeved t-shirt, and hiking boots. He brought with him two lightweight plastic carriers that he set on the floor, one medium and one large. The coffee carafe had attracted his attention the minute he arrived, but he'd been polite about it. Let's see what you got here. He eased himself down to the floor on one bent knee and then stretched out on his tummy and put his face near the carafe. He gave the glass a tap, but the spider was too busy to care. He was feeling his way around the perimeter, hoping for a little doorway to freedom. Byron said, "He's a beauty." "Oh, thanks. This fellow's a Mexican red-legged tarantula, Brachypelma emilia, maybe 5 or 6 years old. A male, judging by his color. See how dark he is? The females are closer to a soft brown. Where'd you find him?" "Actually, he found me. Someone left him for me in a padded envelope." He looked at me with interest. "What's the occasion?" No occasion, just a very sick practical joke." "Some joke? You can't buy a red-legged spiderling for less than $125. "Yeah, well, nothing but the best for me. When you say Mexican red-legged, does that mean they're only found in Mexico?" "Not exactly. In states like Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas, they're not uncommon. I breed Chaco Golden Knees and Cobalt Blues. Neither cost as much as this guy. I have a pair of Brazilian Salmon Pinks I picked up for $10 each. You know you can actually train tarantulas as pets?" "Really?" I said. I had no idea. "Heck yes. They're quiet and they don't shed. They do molt and you have to be a little bit careful about bites. The venom's harmless to humans, but you'll have swelling at the site and sometimes numbness or itching. Goes away pretty quick. It's nice you didn't kill him." "I'm a conservationist at heart," I said. "Listen, if you're going to pick him up, please warn me. I'm leaving the room." "Nah, this guy's had enough trauma for one day. I don't want him thinking I'm the enemy." While I watched, he removed the ventilated lid from the medium-sized clear plastic box. He took a pencil from my desk, picked up the carafe, and used it to coax the spider into the carrier. The pencil was going, too. He snapped the lid in place and used the pop-up handle to lift him up to face level again. "If you want him, he's yours," I said. "Really?" He smiled, his face flushing with delight. I hadn't given a fellow that much pleasure since Cheney and I broke up. "I'll also be happy to pay for your time. You really saved my life." "Oh, man, this is payment enough. If you change your mind, I'll be happy to bring him back." I said, "Go, and God bless." Once the door closed behind him, I sat at my desk and had a nice long chat with myself. A Mexican red-legged? Bite my ass. This was Solana's doing. If her purpose was to scare the shit out of me, she'd done well. I wasn't sure what the tarantula represented to her, but from my perspective, it spoke of a twisted mind at work. She was putting me on notice, and I got the point. Any relief my morning run had generated went straight out the window. That first glimpse of Spider would be with me for life. I still had the willies. I put together the files I'd need, picked up my portable Smith Corona, locked the office door behind me, and loaded the car. The office felt contaminated. I'd work from home. I made it through the day. Though easily distracted, I was determined to be productive. I needed comfort, and for lunch, I allowed myself a sandwich made with half an inch of olive pimento cheese spread and whole grain bread. I cut it in quarters the way I had as a child, and I savored every tangy bite. I wasn't all that strict about dinner either, I must confess. I needed to sedate myself with food and drink. I know it's very naughty to use alcohol to relieve tension, but wine is cheap, it's legal, and it does the job. Up to a point. When I went to bed that night, I didn't have to worry about lying awake. I was ever so slightly inebriated, and I slept like a stone. It was the faintest whiff of cold air that woke me. I was sleeping in sweats, in anticipation of my early morning run, but
Even suited up, I was cold. I glanced at the digital clock, but the face was black, and I realized the usual soft purring of appliances had ceased. The power had gone out. An irksome business for someone as time-oriented as I was. I stared up through the plexiglass skylight, but couldn't estimate the hour. If I'd known it was early, 2 or 3 a.m., I'd have pulled the covers over my head and slept until my inner alarm clock woke me at 6. Idly, I wondered if the outage included the whole neighborhood. In Santa Teresa, if the wind blows wrong, there are tiny breaks in the service, and the flow of electricity cuts out. Seconds later, the clocks might flash on again, but the numbers continue to blink merrily, announcing the upset. In this instance, there was none of that. I could have groped across the bed table for my watch. By squinting and angling the face, I might have been able to see the hands, but it didn't seem to matter much. I was puzzled by the cold air, and I wondered if I'd left a window open somewhere. It didn't seem likely. In winter, I keep the studio snug, often closing the interior shutters to eliminate drafts. I looked down to the foot of my bed. There was someone, a woman, standing there, motionless. The nighttime darkness is never absolute. Given the city's light pollution, I can always distinguish gradients of light, starting with the paler shades of gray and deepening to charcoal. If I wake during the night, this is what allows me to wander the studio without bothering to turn on lights. It was Solana, in my house, in my loft, staring down at me while I slept. Fear spread through me slowly like ice. The cold moved out from my core, all the way to the tips of my fingers and toes, in the same way water gradually turns solid when a lake freezes over. How had she gotten in? I waited, wondering if the specter would resolve into an ordinary object. A jacket thrown over the railing, a garment bag hanging from the hinge on my closet door. At first, my mind was blank with disbelief. There was no way, no way she could have gained entry. Then I remembered Henry's house key attached to a white cardboard tag, with Pitts neatly printed on it by means of identification. Gus kept the key in his desk drawer, where I'd come upon it the first time I searched for Melanie's phone number. Henry had told me there was a time when Gus had brought in the mail and watered the plants when Henry was out of town. Henry's locks and mine were keyed the same. And when I thought about it, I couldn't remember securing the burglar chain, which meant once she unlocked the door, there was nothing preventing her from coming in. What could be easier? I might just as well have left my front door ajar. She must have sensed I was awake and looking at her. We stared at each other. There was no need for conversation. If she was armed with a weapon, this was the moment she'd strike, knowing I was aware of her, but powerless to fight. Instead, she moved away. I saw her turn toward the spiral stairs and disappear. I sat straight up in bed, my heart banging. I pushed the covers aside and reached for my running shoes, shoving my bare feet into them. The lighted clock face shone bright again, numbers flashing. It was 3:05. Solana must have found the breaker box. Now the power was on, and I skittered down the stairs. My front door stood open, and I could hear her unhurried footsteps receding along the walk. There was an insolence in the leisurely way she left. She had all the time in the world. I closed the door, turned the thumb lock, slid on the chain, and hurried into the downstairs bathroom. Through the window, I could see a squared-off view of the street. I pressed my forehead against the glass, checking in both directions. There was no sign of her. I expected to hear a car start, but the quiet was unbroken. I sank down on the rim of the tub and rubbed my face with my hands. Now that she was gone, I was more afraid than I'd been when she was there. In the dark of the bathroom, I closed my eyes and projected myself into her head, seeing the situation as she must view it. First the tarantula. Now this. What was she up to? If she wanted me dead, which she did without doubt, why hadn't she acted while she had the chance? Because she wanted to demonstrate her power over me. She was telling me she could walk through walls, that it would never be safe for me to close my eyes. Wherever I went and whatever I did, I'd be vulnerable. At work, at home, I was at her mercy, alive purely at her whim, but possibly not for long. What were the other messages embedded in the first? Starting from the obvious, she wasn't in Mexico. She'd left the car near the border, so we'd assume she'd fled. Instead, she'd doubled back. By what means? I hadn't heard a car start. But she could have parked two blocks away and made the rest of the trip to and from my bedside on foot. The problem, from her perspective, was that buying or renting a car required personal identification. Peggy Klein had snatched her driver's license, and without that, she was screwed. She couldn't be certain her face, her name, and her various aliases hadn't been burning up the wires. For all she knew, the minute she tried to use her phony credit cards, she'd announce her location and law enforcement would close in. In the weeks she'd been gone, she probably hadn't applied for work, which meant she was living on cash. Even if she found a way to bypass the issue of ID, buying or renting a car would eat up valuable resources. Once she killed me, she'd have to lie low, which meant she'd have to save her cash reserves to support herself until she found someone new to prey on. Those matters took patience and careful planning. She hadn't had time enough to set up a new life, so how had she managed to get here? By bus or by train? Traveling by bus was cheap and largely anonymous. Traveling by train would allow her to disembark a scant three blocks from where I lived. First thing the next morning, I told Henry about my night visitor and my theory of how she'd gotten in. After that, I called a locksmith and had my locks changed. Henry and Gus had their locks changed as well. I also called Cheney and told him what had happened so he could put the word out on his end. I'd given him photographs of Solana so the officers on every shift would be familiar with her face. Once again, my nerves were on edge. I pressed Lonnie about getting the judge's order signed so I could have my guns back in my possession. I don't know how he did it, but I had the order in hand and retrieved them from the gun shop that afternoon. I didn't picture myself walking around like a gunslinger, armed to the teeth, but I had to do something to make myself feel safe. Wednesday morning, when I returned from my run, there was a photograph taped to my front door. Solana again. What now? Frowning, I pulled it free. I let myself in, locked the door behind me, and turned on the desk lamp. I studied the image, knowing what it was. She'd snapped a picture of me the day before somewhere along my jogging route. I recognized the dark blue sweats I'd worn. It had been nippy out, and I'd wrapped a lime green scarf around my neck. The first and only time. It must have been late in the run because my face was flushed, and I was breathing through my mouth. In the background, I could see part of a building with a street lamp in front. The angle was odd, but I couldn't think what that meant. The message was clear enough. Even the run, which had been my salvation, was under siege. I sat down on the couch and put a hand over my mouth. My fingers were cold, and I found myself shaking my head. I couldn't live this way. I couldn't spend the rest of my life on red alert. I stared at the photo, and another thought occurred to me. She wanted me to find her. She was showing me where she was. But she wouldn't make it easy. Being sly was her way of maintaining the upper hand. Wherever she was, all she had to do was wait, while I was forced to do the legwork. The challenge was to see if I was smart enough to track her down. If not, she'd send me another clue. What I couldn't get was her game plan. She had something in mind, but I couldn't read her well enough to figure out what it was. It was an interesting display of power. I had more at stake than she did, but she had nothing to lose. I showered and dressed in sweats and running shoes. For breakfast, I ate cold cereal. I washed the bowl and spoon and set them in the rack to dry. I went upstairs and took out my fanny pack. I left the key picks in their compact leather folder, but removed the pick gun to make room for the H and K, which I loaded and tucked in its place. I left the house with Solana's photo of me in hand. The other snapshots I carried were of her. I walked my route, down Cabana, left on State. I kept an eye on the passing landscape, trying to identify the point from which the photo had been taken. It looked like the eye of the camera was angled downward, but not by much. If she'd been out in the open, I would have seen her. During a run, I keep my focus on the run itself, but not to the exclusion of all else. I was usually out before the sun came up, and as empty as the streets appeared to be, there were always other people about, and not all of them good. I was interested in being fit, but not at the cost of being foolish. I was torn between a natural desire to be thorough and a need to get to the point. I compromised by walking half the route. My hunch was that her location was on the beach side of the freeway. The buildings on the upper part of State had a very different look to them than the one in the photograph. I'd taken this route for weeks, and it surprised me how different the streets looked when I traveled at a walking pace. Retail stores were still closed, but the popular sidewalk cafes were filled. People were heading off to the gym or returning to their cars, damp from their workouts. At the intersection of Neil and State, I turned and retraced my steps. It helped that there weren't that many lampposts, two to every block. I scanned the buildings as high as the second floor, checking fire escapes and balconies where she might have hidden. I looked for windows located at a level that would reproduce the angle from which the snapshot had been taken. I'd almost reached the railroad tracks by then, and I was running short of geography. It was the section of building she'd caught in the frame that finally tipped me off. It was the t-shirt shop across the street. The skirting beneath the plate glass window was quite distinct now that I looked at it. Slowly, I walked on until the slice of background matched the picture. Then I turned and looked behind me. The Paramount Hotel. I checked the window visible just above the marquee. It was a corner room, probably large because I could see a deep balcony that wrapped around both sides of the building at that point. Maybe the original hotel had had a restaurant up there, with French doors that opened onto the balcony so patrons could enjoy the morning air at breakfast, and later the setting sun at the cocktail hour. I went into the lobby through the front doors. The remodel had been done with an impeccable eye for detail. The architect had managed to capture the old glamour without sacrificing current standards of elegance. It looked like all the old brass fixtures were still in place, burnished to a high shine. I knew this to be untrue, as the originals had been looted in the days just after the hotel closed. Murals in muted tones covered the walls, with scenes depicting the fashionable set in residence at the Paramount Hotel in the 1940s. The doorman was on hand, as well as numerous bellhops toting luggage for the patrons checking in. A party of rail-thin women in jaunty hats played a hand of bridge in one corner of the lobby. Two of the four had foxtail furs tossed over their suit jackets with the big shoulder pads. There was no hint that a war was going on except for the scarcity of men. The patio and pool area had been brushed in, the images lifted from old photographs. I could see six cabanas on the far side of the pool, which was flanked with ponytail palms and the larger, more graceful queen palms. What I hadn't realized, peering at the construction through the barrier, was that the pool extended under a glass wall into the lobby itself. The lobby portion was largely decorative, but the overall effect was nice. In the mural, there were vintage automobiles parked at the street, and no hint of the various tourist-oriented businesses that now stretched along State. Just to the right, there was a wide carpeted stair in trompe l'oeil, curving up to the mezzanine. I turned and saw the same stairway in reality. I went up, and at the top turned to my right so that I was facing the street. What I'd imagined was a restaurant or lounge was actually a lavish corner suite. The brass number on the door was an ornate 2. I could hear a television set blaring inside. I went to the window at the end of the hall and looked out. Solana must have snapped the picture from a window in the suite, because the perspective was slightly off from the place where I stood. I went down the wide stairs to the lobby. The desk clerk was in his 30s with a thin, bony face, and hair slicked back with pomade in a style I'd seen only in photographs taken during the 40s. His suit had a retro look to it as well. "Good morning, may I help you?" he said. His nails had the shine of a recent manicure. "Yes, I'm interested in the suite on the mezzanine," I said, and gestured toward the stairs. That's the Ava Gardner suite. It's occupied at the moment. How soon would you need the reservation?
Actually, I don't. I think a friend of mine checked in and I thought I'd pop in and surprise her.
She's asked not to be disturbed.
I frowned slightly. That doesn't sound like her. Usually she has a steady stream of visitors. Of course, she's in the process of divorcing, and maybe she's worried her ex will try tracking her down. Can you tell me what name she used? Her married name was Brody.
I'm afraid I couldn't give you that information. It's against hotel policy. The privacy of our guests is our first priority.
What if I showed you a photograph? You could at least confirm that it's my friend. I'd hate to bang on the door if I'm making a mistake.
Why don't you give me your name and I'll ring her?
But that would spoil the surprise. I brought my fanny pack around from the back to the front and unzipped the smaller of the two compartments. I took out the photo of Solana and put it on the counter.
I'm afraid I can't help, he said.
He was careful to maintain eye contact, but I knew he couldn't resist a peek. His eyes flicked down. I said nothing, but I gazed at him steadily.
Anyway, she has company at the moment. A gentleman just went up.
So much for his respect for her privacy. A gentleman?
A handsome white-haired fellow, tall, very trim. I'd say he was in his 80s.
Did he give you his name?
He didn't have to. She called down and said she was expecting a Mr. Pitts, and when he arrived, I should send him right up, which is what I did.
I could feel the color leave my face. I want you to call the police, and I want you to do it right now. He looked at me, a quizzical smile playing across his lips, as though this were a hoax being filmed by hidden cameras to test his response.
Call the police? That's what the gentleman said. Are you two serious?
Shit! Just do it! Ask for a detective named Cheney Phillips. Can you remember that?
Of course, he said primly. I'm not stupid.
I stood there. He hesitated and then reached for the phone. I moved away from the desk and took the stairs two at a time. Why would she have called Henry? And what could she have said that would get him over here? When I approached the Ava Gardner suite for the second time, the volume on the blaring television had been turned down. The modernization and restoration of the hotel, happily from my perspective, hadn't included the installation of card-operated locks. I didn't recognize the lock brand, but how different could it be? I unzipped my fanny pack and took out the leather folder with its five picks. I'd have preferred the cover of loud music and talk, but I couldn't take the chance. I was just about to set to work when the door opened, and I saw Solana standing there. She said, "I can save you the effort. Why don't you come in? The desk clerk phoned to tell me you were on your way." The fuckhead, I thought. I stepped into the room. She closed the door behind me and secured the burglar chain. This was the sitting room. Doors on the left stood open, revealing two separate bedrooms and a bathroom done in an old-fashioned white marble streaked with gray. Henry was out cold, lying on the plump upholstered sofa with an IV line in his arm, the needle taped in place. His color was still good, and I could see the steady rise and fall of his chest. What worried me was the loaded syringe lying on the coffee table beside a crystal bowl filled with roses. The French doors stood open, shears lifted by a breeze. I could see the newly planted palms near the flagstone patio surrounding the pool. The terracing was still under construction, but it looked like work had been completed on the pool, which was now in the process of being filled. Solana allowed me time to get my bearings, enjoying the fear that must have been written in my face.
What have you done to him?
Sedated him.
He was upset when he realized you weren't here.
Why would he think I was here?
Because I called him and told him so.
I said you'd come to the hotel and attacked me. I said I'd hurt you very badly, and now you were close to death, and begging me to let you see him. He didn't believe me at first, but I insisted, and he was afraid of being wrong. I told him I'd put a tap on his phone line, and if he called the police, you'd be dead before he hung up. He was very quick, knocking on my door in less than 15 minutes.
What did you inject him with?
I'm sure the name of the drug would be meaningless to you. It's used to render a patient immobile before surgery.
I hit him with something else first, an injection in his thigh, very fast acting. He went down like a tree toppling in a high wind. He doesn't seem to be conscious, but I can assure you he is. He can hear everything. He just can't move. What do you want from me? Just the pleasure of watching your face as he dies, she said. You took away the love of my life, and now I'll take yours. Ah, but first, let me have your fanny pack. Gus told me you own a gun. It wouldn't surprise me if you had it with you. I don't, but you're welcome to look. I unbuckled the pack and held it out to her. When she reached for it, I grabbed her by the arm and jerked her toward me. She lost her balance and toppled forward as I brought my right knee up to meet her face. There was a lovely popping sound that I hoped was her nose. Sure enough, blood poured down her face. Her eyelids fluttered briefly, and she sprawled to her knees, her hands thrown out in front of her as she tried catching herself. I kicked her in the side and stomped on one of her outstretched hands. I snatched the syringe from the coffee table and crushed it with my heel. I stood beside Henry and pulled the tape from his arm. I wanted that IV line out of him. Solana saw what I was doing and came after me in a flying tackle. I stumbled backward onto the coffee table and dragged her with me. The coffee table tipped over. The bowl of roses bounced on the carpet and settled upright, the roses still perfectly arranged. I grabbed the crystal bowl by the rim and hit her on the upper arm, which loosened her grip. I flipped over to my hands and knees, and she launched herself at me again. She hung on while I rammed her in the side repeatedly with my elbow. I kicked back at her, catching her on the thigh, inflicting as much damage as I could with the heel of my running shoe. The woman was relentless. She came after me again, and this time grabbed me around the arms, pinning my elbows to my sides. We were in such close contact, I couldn't shake her off. I laced my hands together and brought them straight up, which broke her hold. I torqued myself to one side, grabbed her by the wrist, and pivoted. Her body arced across my hip, and she went down. I hooked an elbow around her neck and dug my fingers into one eye socket. She shrieked in pain and covered her face with her hands. I pushed her away from me, breathing heavily. I could hear sirens in the street, and I prayed they were heading toward us. With one eye bloody, she turned, her expression wild with pain. She found Henry in her visual field, and in two strides was on him with her hands around his throat. I leaped at her. I boxed her ears, caught her by the hair, and hauled her off of him. She staggered two steps back, and I shoved her hard in the chest. She banged backward through the French doors onto the balcony. I was gasping for breath, and so was she. I watched her use the railing to pull herself up. I knew I'd hurt her. She'd hurt me, too, but I wouldn't find out to what extent until the adrenaline receded. For the moment, I was tired, and not altogether certain I could take her on again. She glanced toward the street, where I could hear police cars, sirens wailing, come screeching to a stop. We were only one floor above, and it wouldn't take them long to come pounding up the steps. I made my way to the door and removed the burglar chain. I turned the thumb lock and opened the door, and then leaned against the frame. When I turned back to look at her, the balcony was empty. I heard a scream from below. I crossed to the French doors and went out on the balcony. I looked over the rail. The water in the pool showed a spreading cloud of pink. She struggled briefly and then went still. It made no difference whether she'd fallen or jumped. She'd landed face down, hitting her head on the edge of the pool before she slid into the water. At the shallow end, the water was only 2 feet deep, but that was sufficient. She drowned before anyone could get to her. Epilogue. Henry was taken to St. Terry's by ambulance. He recovered from his ordeal without incident. I think he felt foolish that Solana had deceived him, but I'd have done the same thing in his place. We're each of us more protective of the other than we are of ourselves. The Fredrickson suit against Lisa Ray was dropped. I came close to feeling sorry for Hetty Buchwald, who'd been convinced that their claim was legitimate. By the time I was able to swing by the laundromat to tell Melvin he was off the hook, the milk truck had disappeared, and so had he. I completed an affidavit of inability to serve process and filed it with the court clerk, which ended my official connection to the man. I wasn't surprised to find him gone, but it was hard to believe he'd give up his vigil over his youngest grandson. I kept wishing there were some way to make contact, but I'd never heard his daughter's name, first or last. I had no idea where she lived or where her youngest boy was enrolled. It might have been the preschool near City College or another daycare center I'd spotted 6 blocks away. Even now, I find myself driving around the neighborhood where Melvin worked, checking nursery schools, scanning children on the playground. I coast by parks in the area, thinking I might catch sight of a white-haired gentleman in a brown leather bomber jacket. Every time I see a kid with a lollipop, I study the grown-ups nearby, wondering if one of them offered the child a piece of candy in that first tentative overture. At the kiddie pool, I stand near the fence and watch the little kids at play, splashing water on each other, gliding on their tummies in the wading pool, while they walk their hands along the bottom and pretend to swim. They are so beautiful, so sweet. I can't imagine anyone willfully harming a child. Yet, some people do. There are thousands of convicted sex offenders in the state of California alone. Of those, a small but unsettling number are unaccounted for on any given day. I don't want to think about predators. I know they exist, but I prefer to focus on the best in human nature: compassion, generosity, a willingness to come to the aid of those in need. The sentiment may seem absurd, given our daily ration of news stories detailing thievery, assault, rape, murder, and other treacheries. To the cynics among us, I must sound like an idiot. But I do hold to the good, working wherever possible to separate the wicked from that which profits them. There will always be someone poised to take advantage of the vulnerable, the very young, the very old, and the innocent of any age. Though I know this from long experience, I refuse to feel discouraged. In my own unassuming way, I know I can make a difference. You can as well. Respectfully submitted, Kinsey Milhone. This is Judy Kaye. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Tea is for Trespass by Sue Grafton. This program was directed by John Wager, executive producer Sherry Huber. This program was edited at John Marshall Sound. Text copyright 2007 by Sue Grafton. Production copyright 2007, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.